Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about the third episode of Nicholas Copernicus from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So what's happened here is I've read the popular science version, which has him as a closet scientist, a scientist, embryonic scientist in waiting, and fearful of the church, sort of a general anti-church propaganda. Not that I'm pro-church or anything like that, but I do think what's hidden in behind is the other agenda, the sort of the my mates who are science teachers are great people. They don't know any science, they don't know any history, but I like them, and here's a general story about them. They've just got the look and feel and belief in science. It's almost a religious belief in science which has come up across there. So it turns out that Copernicus had a very much Aristotelian view, and he was actually going backwards from Ptolemy and trying to work things out with epicyclists, which I have to go in. And he indeed was not too interested or too concerned about the church. In fact, the church had no position on it. And it's a construct that Bruno was burnt at the stake for being a Copernican. He was burnt at the stake for being a witch more than anything else like that. So it's interesting. Last episode we learnt that he wrote six books, and the need to publish, he was more concerned about the quality of publication. He was in the backwater, so he had no feel for the busyness of it, or the technology at the time. So he was in a foggy backwater in Europe. And he wasn't really in Poland. He was in a free city, which is slightly different from being in Poland. He was in the free city of Fromberg. So exactly what does a free city mean? It means that there's particularly no particular state. The city is a sort of like a medieval city-state come along. So I don't know exactly what that means. There's the Teutonic Knights going around at this time. Again, that's going to be difficult, interesting to read about. And we read that he was, you know, the Ptolemaic system. It was not accepted by the church. It was actually ridiculed by the Arabs and actually ridiculed by the people at the time. They said, look, if this system's right, okay, the moon should double in size, and there's just a whole series of problems. It also had the orbits of the Mercury and Venus being the same as that of the Sun, more or less, but not around the its positions around the Sun. So it's coming across, and he in fact had really poor statistic. He said 9 months for Venus, 2 years for Mars, 18 for Jupiter, 30 for Saturn, and things like that. And the stars, still not in three dimensions, a starry firmament, a sphere of the universe, much further away, a two-dimensional shape. Now there's, we're coming to page 4, Reticulus and the Narito Primum. So Reticulus wrote a summary of this person's work. So how it got famous? I think it's also partly because books weren't being published, and they weren't actually being sucked into the big publication system. So imagine that there's no big supermarkets, distribution chains, internet to support publications. You can't just go on Amazon, I'd like Copernicus, thank you. And so it probably meant that there were other people coming on. Now, Reticulus was a Lutheran, and there was the Protestants going into it. Now, what is it? Martin Luther King was anti-Copernican, so he was perhaps the only more political person. And Lutheran priest did something which upset people, but it meant that the Copernican system slipped into the Lutheran world by saying, "Hang on, this is, it's just mental mind games of astronomers. The other really interesting thing is that Copernicus, in studying medicine, required the study of astrology. And astrology, so, you know, it's sort of like individualized medicine. Do I bleed you or do I pronounce you dead? You're a Taurus, and the moon is in such and such a place, and the sun is there, and the various planets are here and there. Let me work this out. Ah, you're stuffed, mate. Or, hang on, if you can just give me all your livelihood according to this, you'll survive. So, astrology. So, Copernicus and the world, they were into astronomy because of astrology. It's quite amazing. And so, I think they had the quantum astrologer. And the quantum, I've forgotten what it's called. The handbook, the quantum astrologer's handbook. Story of a man, the medical person at the time, had to study astrology. Okay, although Copernicus received encouragement to publish his book from his close friend, the bishop Clemo Tiedemann Gies, 1480 to 1550, and from the cardinal Capola Nicholas Schollenberg, it was the arrival of George Johann Rictus from Fromberg that solved the needs of a supportive and stimulating colleague and a student of mathematics, as well as Lutheran, for Lutheran theology. In 1536, Rictus' book took leave of absence. I'm sure we'll see this. I sort of really feel I've read this. Oh well. Let's read it again. From Wittenberg, a major centre for mathematics. It's not known whether Rictus learned about Copernicus' theory. He may have been convinced to visit Copernicus by one of his earlier scholars. He had visited Johann Schuler, though, as noted, in early 1530, knowledge of Copernicus' new theory was circulating in Europe, even reaching the high and learned circles of the Vatican. Rictus brought with him some mathematical and astronomical volumes, which provided Copernicus with some important material and showed him the quality and mathematical printing available by the German centres of publishing. Rictus' present of the 1533 edition of Regimatus, all kinds of triangles, yeah, I'm pretty sure I've read this, for example, convinced Copernicus to revise his section on trigonometry. But Rictus was partly interested in showing Copernicus the work of the Nuremberg publisher Johann Petrus as a possible publisher of Copernicus' volume. And I think I do remember doing this. This is unfortunately stroke stuff. Your memory isn't absolutely crash hot. But I sort of remember saying that this is sort of like people wanting to be the mechanics. You know, Renault wants to do a Formula One car because of the prestige and the advertising of it. But they've got no intention of providing everyone with a Formula One car. Schurer and Nuremberg possibly suggested Petrus was offering to publish Copernicus' work, if not advertising by this notice that he was already committed to do so. Rictus wrote Narrata Prima in 1540, an introduction to the theories of Copernicus, which was published and circulated. This further encouraged Copernicus to publish the Revolutions, which he had been working on since he published the Commentarius. The Narrata Prima was written in 1539 and took the form of a letter to Johann Schoner announcing Copernicus' finding and describing the contents of the Revolutions. Now, although we have a letter, a letter and we read the letter, a lot of, investigative reporting, rule report, the reporter's story, or the reporter's story of something, finding that, or it'll take a view and draw us in on that way. So it's, although it sounds a bit odd, it's actually really close to the sort of investigative reporters or a documentary will have it. A hint, it will be one's family's story or something like that. He dealt with such topics as the motions of fixed stars, tropical year, obliquity of the ecliptic, the problems resulting from the motion of the sun, motion of the earth and other planets, libations, longitude of the other five planets, the apparent deviation of the planets from the ecliptic. Now, libration I will have to go across, but the moon libates, that is, as it orbits us in an elliptical orbit, it appears, its axis appears to wobble a bit like an Indian of speaking to you. He asserted that the heliocentric universe should have been adopted because it is better accounted for such phenomena as the precession of the equinox and the change of the obliquity of the ecliptic. It resulted in the diminution of the eccentricity of the sun. The sun was the center of different planets. It allowed the circles and the universe to revolve uniformly and regularly. It satisfied the appearance more readily with fewer explanations necessary. It united all spheres into one system. Reticulus added astrological predictions and a number of mysticism, which were absent in Copernicus's work. And this is one of the really complex things. So you get one of these works, it's written in Latin, so you've got schoolboy Latin, Google Translate to help you through, and then you read along, and it's sort of like, and the cat sat on the third mat and rose its paw six times. It's just so hard to get your head reading the actual original Latin. The Narita Prima was printed in 1540 at Gdansk. Now, Danzig, I do remember this. Thus, it was the first printed description of Copernicus' thesis. Reticus sent a copy to Achilles Prima Grasser in Friedrich, now his hometown in modern-day Austria. And Grasser wrote a foreword and published a second edition, which was produced in 1541 in Basel. It was published again in 1596 as an appendix to the first edition of Johannes Kepler's Mysterium Cosmologum, Secret of the Universe, the first completely Copernican work by the adherents since the publication of Copernicus and Reticus. Now, it's interesting that Kepler sent his work to Galileo, and Galileo reduced it. So it's really hard to understand how deeply in the thrall they were of Aristotle. So Galileo was deeply in the thrall of Aristotle and sort of mysticism. And when you read a lot of these things, you say, hang on, why couldn't someone... It's like a lot of the work was based, when you came down to it, Dante. And Dante's thing was he was following Beatrice's... a woman he was hot on in love, and he somehow rode his horse through a cavity on the earth and rode down to, which is all okay, it's sort of divine inspired, but you know, in terms of the overall, his evidence, that evidence which got everything up and running, everyone took as major evidence, is sort of like Donald Trump saying, well, you know, I was in my golf course and you know, the Mormon, Book of Mormon was there, and then I walked through a hole in a bunker and got people. You would surely, it's not that the telescope is giving him information, he was getting other information from these weird and wonderful sources. So there was no really sense of science in that sense. So we didn't have a really high quality of scientific rigour. Now, I'm sure I probably read this one as Printing on the Revolutions, and there was Sanders' preface. So Sanders is this Lutheran person who puts in a preface, which means the book goes, it's sort of like making it a stealth feature. And so if they were imagining a battle tank to come out blasting it, and he made it a stealth tank with an olive reeve and all this type of stuff on top of it. Okay, the publication of Reticulus Narita Prima did not create a big stir against the heliocentric thesis. So Copernicus decided to publish on the revolutions. So it's sort of like a scouting paper. He added a dedication to Pope Paul III, probably for political reasons, which he expressed his hesitancy about publishing the work and the reasons he finally decided to publish it. He gave credit to Schoenberg, Gies, and encouraging them to publish amid the mention of ridiculous, but it would have been insulting to the Pope during the tense period of the Reformation to give credit to the Protestant minister. So you've got the Hundred Years' War, where a third of Europe puts everybody to the death in terms of sort of Islamic State and the Caliphate. But, you know, Protestantism and stuff like that, that people were just butchering the stuffings out of each other. I have my personal theory is that the lethality of the Middle Ages, the Middle Ages and Renaissance, it was partly fueled by the sort of cocked by courtly love. So it was courtly love is where there's the married woman in the estate and stuff like that. There's the guy. So the married woman has a lot of wealth and is health and looked after and stuff like that. So you've got a whole heap of people, wannabes, usurpers in there, and so it's allowed in medieval times to actually profess love to a married woman in a complex way, in extremely flowery ways of love, but it also meant that a lot of that love and stuff like that could only operate if there was a high mortality rate, in that people got killed and knocked off and with plague and intrigue and stuff like that. And it meant, it's sort of like liquidation in modern capitalism, when the asset of love, one asset of love got liquidated, you're able to rush in really quickly and replace it, because your courtly love was sort of like love in waiting, so you could go across. And then you've got all these men working in situations in this pretty horrible, strange, complex place. So courtly love had a sort of a dual role of stabilising society and cocking it to run forward. So these people would be dying left, right and centre. And it wouldn't be a long time before people got married. If you look at Shakespeare's plays, a lot of things was sword fighting, death, and getting married really quickly. So that led to a lot of complexity. It's sort of almost like it's trying to understand the madness of the Middle Ages is something which is sort of rather lost. You really need to listen to Middle Ages music, chanting. It's all really, really get into it. And you do miss it if the Middle Ages is turned into a anti-science, zero creativity muck about. It's sort of like someone who really doesn't understand the nuances of what's going on in a preschool, so to speak. So a preschool teacher will look at things and see subtle things in play, see little the art. There are a lot of Middle Ages art is actually preschool art, quite honestly, isn't it, when you look at it. To come across here. I can't remember what I've read up to. He dismissed critics who might have claimed that it was against the Bible by giving them an example of the 4th century Christian apologist, Lacinus, who has rejected the spherical shape of Earth by asserting astronomy is written for astronomers. In other words, theologians should not meddle with it. He pointed out to the difficulty of the calendar reform because of the motions of heavenly bodies were inadequately known. He called the attention to the fact that, quote, if the motions of other planets are correlated with the orbiting of the Earth and are computed with the revolution of each planet, not only do their phenomena follow therefrom, but also the order and size of all planets and spheres, the Earth, are computed by the revolution of each planet. Not only do their phenomena flow therefrom, but the order and size of the planets and spheres and the heavens, its earth, is so linked together that no portion of it can be shifted without disrupting the remaining parts of the universe as a whole. Now, we must also admit that calling them spheres is the ancient Greek view, because when they looked out through the heavens, they could only see a dot, and to say that's a sphere and not a triangle or a square or it's three-dimensional, there's no information. All you see is a point of light. It's amazing that once you know that Jupiter is a sphere, you see the point of light, and it looks, it's not twinkling, it's a lot bigger. You sort of know that from some maths, the turbulence and the integration of the turbulence to come across. But so these people, when they're talking about the planets as spheres, they're talking about spheres based not on the pioneer flying past, not on telescopes, but on Greek assertions. And the music, and it's a sphere because it's a heavenly body, and a sphere is perfect. Yeah, nothing to do with gravity pulling it in. Rheticus returned to Wittenberg in 1541, and the following year received another leave of absence, which time took the manuscript of the Revolution to Rheticus, the publishing in Nuremberg. Rheticus oversaw the printing of most of the text. However, Rheticus was forced to leave Nuremberg later that year because he was appointed professor of mathematics at the University of Leipzig. When he left the rest of the magnificent management of the printing revolutions to Andrew Osandia, a Lutheran minister who was also interested in mathematics and astronomy. Though he saw the project through, Osandia appended an anonymous preface to the work. He claimed that Copernicus was offering a hypothesis, not a true account of the working heavens. Quote, you know, this is almost like your overall chat-up lines of women. This is just a hypothesis that would be put forward by a much better-looking man than myself. Well, blah, blah, blah. Since the astronomer cannot in any way attain to true causes, he will adopt whatever suppositions enabled the motions to be computed correctly, from the principles of geometry for the future as well as the past. The hypothesis need not be true or even probable, which, remarkably, given that he was saying the planets were in absolutely dead-set circular orbits and epicyclets and stuff like that, this is actually, although it's annoying, it's actually true this is actually the truth. He was actually coming up with an intermediary step. Copernicus was getting an intermediary first, almost a step backwards to do it. And so this is, although this is annoying to someone who is in the science, I want history to be like that. Remarkably, this is actually really close to the truth. This clearly contradicted the body of the work. Both Rheticus and Gies protested, and Rheticus crossed it out in his copy. So we're told, I don't know if he's got a copy, but we've now got books and sufficient number published, and people valued books enough, so I'm sure this would be in the Gutenberg library. Wouldn't it be fantastic to open up one of these books and with your schoolboy Latin just, you know, do an individual paragraph and stuff like that. 16th sectionary, reactions to On the Revolutions, page 4. Copernicus's fame and book made its way across Europe over the next 50 years. The second edition was brought out in 1566. Its Greenwich census of the existing copies showed the book was read and commented on by astronomers. And noted the majority of 16th century astronomers thought eliminating the equant was Copernicus' big achievement. So, yeah. So what exactly is it? Well, Martin Luther may have made negative comments about Copernicus because the idea was of the heliocentric universe seemed to contradict the Bible. Philip Melanchthon, who presided over the curriculum of the University of Wittenberg, eventually accepted the importance of the teaching of Copernicus' idea. It's perhaps because Osandia's preface made the work more palatable. His son-in-law, Caspar Purser, taught astronomy there and began teaching Copernicus' work. As a result, the University of Wittenberg became the centre of Copernicus' work was studied. But Rheticus was the only Wittenberg Galla, who adopted some of Copernicus' mathematical models. Scholar who accepted the heliocentric idea. Robert Westman suggested that there was a Wittenberg interpretation. Astronomers appreciated and adopted some of Copernicus' mathematical models, but rejected his cosmology. And some were pleased with the replacement of the equants with epicyclets. So it wasn't a full thing. They didn't take the cosmology, they took the maths and epicyclets. One of those was Erasmus Reinhold, a leading astronomer in Wittenberg who became dean and rector. He produced a new set of planetary tables from Copernicus' works, the Putanic tables, though Greenwich pointed out, quote, there was relatively little to distinguish between the accuracy of Alphonse's tables and Putanic tables. So I think Alphonse would be Portuguese, because Portuguese are about to break out at this stage. The latter was more widely adopted. Gingerich plausibly suggested the fact that the Putanic tables were actually predicted the junction between Jupiter and Saturn in 1563 made the difference. Reinhold did not accept the heliocentric theory, but he admired the elimination of the equant. The Putanic table excited interest in Copernicus's work. So it's really interesting, this, isn't it? That the Copernican thing is that he produced a broad set of work, and it's in medieval maths, which is just mind-bogglingly stupid. And everyone began, the scientific community still held on to the geocentric view. Okay, I remember reading this. Tycho Brahe was the greatest astronomical observer before the invention of the telescope. He had a huge metal set square, astrolabe, and he was uncannily just a genius. He was, a bit spectrum-y. I think he's definitely spectrum-y. He called Copernicus the second Ptolemy, and appreciated both the elimination of the equant and the creation of the planetary system. But Tycho did not adopt the Copernican system, partly for the religious reasons that went against the Bible seemed to preach. He therefore adopted a compromise, geoheliostatic. I wish I would have that. So there's geocentric, heliocentric, and geoheliostatic. That is, in which the two inner planets revolved around the Sun, and that system, along with the rest of the planets, revolved around the Earth. Among Catholics, Christus Clavus, the leading astronomer of the 16th century, a Jesuit himself, he incorporated astronomy into the Jesuit curriculum and was a principal scholar behind the creation of the Georgian calendar. Like Wittenberg astronomers, Clavus adopted Copernican mathematical models when he felt them superior, but believed Ptolemy's cosmology, both in the ordering of planets and the use of the equant, was correct. So that's a game. You can't blame the Wittenberg people. He adopted it and taught it, taught everything but the cosmology, the heliocentric bit. He taught a little bit of it, but the heliocentric bit and the equant bit. It is interesting to try and understand the Jesuits. The Jesuits, I think you would say, the Jesuits are sort of like the Marines, the Marine Corps of the Vatican, with the West Point, you know, great things, somehow good, somehow disciplined, somehow Catholic. Pope Clement VII had reacted favourably to the talk about Copernicus' theories, rewarding the speaker with a rare manuscript. I do remember reading this. There's no indication of how Pope Paul III, to whom the Revolutions was dedicated, reacted. However, a trusted advisor, Bartholomew Spina of Pisa, was intended to condemn it and die before his plans were carried out, which is my sort of basic thing, is that your courtly love, the scientists creating reputations and fighting each other, was based on the fact that everyone was dying all the time. And because they lived very short lives, you would back things and back two things. So you wouldn't know who was going to die, but you had to be in position for this turbulence to go across. It was such a chaotic place to come across. And there, who would have known? What would have, if this one person condemned it officially? Well, I don't know whether that would have triggered sort of like Sky News, Andrew Bolt, or one of our right-wing commentators come out, Alan Jones, I've got to try and remember all these things, comes out and says something, it sparks all the other Inquisition people. When you really come to think of it, there is not much difference between Fox News and the Spanish Inquisition. They come along and they hunt witches and they go things like that. They're just a pack of dickheads. Sorry, Yankee people, if you really like that. There is no indication. Okay. When Giorgio Bruno was burned at the stake as a heretic, it had nothing to do with the writings of the support of Copernican cosmology, and was clearly shown by Froner's reconstructions of the accusation against Bruno. Can I say, I'd love to read it. Bruno was my absolute superhero. I could not imagine someone I liked more than Bruno. In the Middle Ages, you have all these people worrying about the church, and he was just so spectrum. Like, he was just the greatest autistic saint of all times. So it's not too, I just so like Bruno. He's such a lovable person. The only thing he didn't do is make himself fireproof. Michael Mostyn, this is getting towards the end, the University of Tilburg, was the earliest astronomer after Ricketts to adopt the Copernican heliocentrism. So he, okay. Although he wrote a popular textbook that was geocentric, he taught his students that the heliocentric system was superior. Just awesome. It's sort of similar to me. I have to teach the Bohr atom, but I know quantum mechanics is much better. Yeah, it's just insane. Isn't that insane? Good on you, Michael. He also rejected Zosander's preface. What is there to reject about the preface? It's sort of like he's too close to it. Mostyn's pupil, Johannes Kepler, wrote the first book since the publication of film, The Revolutions, that openly had the heliocentric orientation. Mysterium Cosmology, Secret of the Universe, and, of course, Kepler eventually built on Copernicus' work to create a much more accurate description of the solar system. Thus ends the reading, and I'm sure that I read too much more into it. Kepler, what an amazing person. I might do Kepler next. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.